From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning, we'll hear from independent college consultant Jill Gully about some new kinds of resources available for families navigating the often overwhelming college admission process. Then we'll speak with Amanda Strong, author of a new book called That Librarian, which tells of the maligning, harassment, and even death threats that she received after speaking out against book banning in her Louisiana town. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. The modern college experience has changed a lot since the parents of most high school seniors attended 20-some years ago. Things like the Common App, soaring tuition costs, changes in financial aid, and a plethora of information sources have made the application process, well, a little overwhelming for many families. But there is help to be found. Today, we'll talk with Jill Gully, a college admission consultant, about the ways that a new breed of independent counselor might be able to help you and your student wade through the often confusing process of finding prospective schools, then applying to them, and eventually choosing a college to attend. Jill Gully, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we could just start with, what is a college consultant?
So in general, a college consultant is somebody who helps a student and family scaffold the college exploration and application process. And there isn't a one size fits all. Some consultants are comprehensive. They do everything from point A to point N. Some only work with students on college essays or helping them compile a college list, a balanced college list. Some help with activity development and summer programming. So there's different services that various folks tend to offer.
I see. So going into that process, maybe it would be good for you to identify the areas that you most want support with as you're looking for somebody to help you, so that you know if they're kind of set up to do that type of thing.
Correct. And I would be remiss if I didn't say some of the best support is within the high schools. It's free support. It's there within the high schools. Every high school has a guidance office, a guidance counselor, a college office. There's a myriad of resources right within the high school. And so someone who is looking to onboard a college consultant would be looking to scaffold things maybe that are not offered within the high school, or their student might need more time than a high school guidance counselor might have to offer given the number of students in their caseload.
That makes a lot of sense. So that is a great place to make sure you've started and at least looked within that counseling office. Those are some hardworking individuals, I know.
They are.
How early in the process of thinking about college should a parent or a student start talking with somebody like you?
For me, I work with students starting in the junior year, but someone who hires somebody late junior year or even over the summer before the senior year, they're not behind in the process. I think that's kind of the number one fear for a lot of families and even students, that they're behind in the process. They are not. In fact, I talked to a parent in Park City a couple of weeks ago who felt like they were behind, and I had to just reassure them they're not. There's plenty of time to scaffold this. But for me, it's really hard to do college consulting with ninth or even 10th graders. There aren't grades. There's not substantive testing. Ninth and 10th grade, to my mind and in my philosophy, are really a time to explore, to see what the high school has to offer, to try and get a sense of which kind of curricular choices are appealing to you. And then we can start really building on that in the junior year and scaffolding out kind of how to go deeper, how to start thinking about what types of colleges might be a good fit. Are there large research universities, small liberal arts colleges? How to put together a college visit if you're going to do something like that over fall or spring break? And then, of course, there is a lot more writing than when you and I applied to college. I applied to four schools. I did the Common App essay, and that was it. It's gotten a lot more intense and a lot more laborious in terms of just the program a student is applying to. So I think that to have a stress-free, manageable, age-appropriate process starting in the junior year is a good time. And I'm not talking every week. I'm talking maybe you talk with somebody once a month, kind of leading up to that summer work.
I see. And you bring up a great point. How has the college application process changed since maybe somebody my age 20, 30 years ago was going through this?
So when I applied, probably same time as you applied, I didn't know about the common application. The common applications made it a lot easier to just send off up to 20 applications. So I'm not recommending a student apply to 20 colleges, but that piece has certainly changed. Just the number, the sheer numbers are of applicants is a lot higher.
Just in case somebody doesn't know what that is, that's an application that a number of schools will accept that common application?
Yes. So I would say that piece has changed. The test has changed a lot. Like if you took the SAT or ACT as a parent, the test that your students are taking now is drastically different. Like vocabulary does not matter nearly as much as it did back in the 1990s in terms of the SAT. So just that test and how to take it and how to really think your way through it has changed quite a bit as well.
Yeah, I was making some extra sharp, nice Ticonderoga pencils for our senior. And he was like, "Mom, we take it on computer."
I sure did.
I was so excited about filling in those little dots so completely. I know that there are rhythms to it, like early decision. How important is choosing a college for early decision in your process? Does that give you an edge at all in getting into a selective college?
You're going to hear different things from different people.
Sure.
I would say if a student is qualified, and by qualified, I mean, we're talking highly selective. So do they have the grades? Do they have the coursework? If scores are required, are their scores within the middle 50%? Are kind of the quantitative pieces there, then yes, an early decision application to a viable reach, not a far reach, not something that you're just kind of throwing it out there with a hope and a prayer, but to a viable school. It can absolutely have an impact. The downside to early decision is that it's a binding process. So if the student's admitted, they're saying, "I'm coming and I will withdraw all applications elsewhere." It's my experience that most students who get into their early decision school, if that's the case, are really excited. They typically hear from that school before winter break. So it's not smooth sailing, take your foot off the pedal, don't worry about senior year anymore. But there's just a little less pressure in that waiting period. It's not the right choice for everyone, though. Some students need to compare financial aid packages. Some students don't have a school that offers early decision that they really love. And it's okay to wait. There's no reason that because your friends are doing it or your neighbor's child's doing it, that it's the best fit for your family. It needs to be a really well thought through decision, but it can have an advantage.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine for the right student who's chosen a viable school, as you mentioned, it would sure make Christmas a lot more relaxing. But if not, then there's still lots of other schools to look at.
Right. And to that point, I would recommend, and with all of my students, every application is ready to go before winter break. Because if they get in, they're celebrating. But if they don't get in, the last thing they're going to want to do is grieve and then have to write 25 pages worth of essays. It should all be done before winter break so that they can go into the computer and press send, and the winter break can just be a 2-week period of hopefully calm.
Yes, indeed. Earlier you mentioned financial aid. Gosh, you look at the costs of college these days and wow, they really seem to be soaring. Has financial aid kept up with that? Are there new programs? Are there any tips you might offer parents who, you know, this is their first college student and they just don't really know how to navigate that part of the process?
I would say, number one, be really upfront with your child about your ability to pay, about whether you need them to wait and compare financial aid packages. I had a nightmare story at my old school where a family knew they needed to consider aid, but they allowed their child to just kind of throw some dream schools out there And guess what? One of those dream schools came back with a yes. And that was a really hard conversation to say to that child that they couldn't send them there. I think just having that conversation early really sets your guidance counselor up to make recommendations where there might be merit awards or where you might get WUI exchange tuition, which is the Western Union exchange between all of the Western states. There's calculators online to really help families figure out what kind of package they might receive. But I think just having an honest assessment with yourself and your child from the onset is a really great way to approach the financial aid piece, because it is predictable and unpredictable in terms of how things might come back.
Wow, that's good advice. Earlier, you mentioned a viable reach. What are the kind of categories maybe somebody who is looking at prospective schools might want to separate their designated choices into?
So everyone's going to have slightly different names. The names that I typically use are likely options. These are schools that, based on all the metrics, all the data, even data from your school, you might be able to see things like scattergrams and whatnot through your school databases. It seems very likely that you're to be admitted to that school. And you've got to also think within the context of what major am I applying to. Getting into one major might be markedly harder than another. A target school is, sometimes it's called a 50-50 school. These are schools where students, they've got the grades, they've got the scores, they've got kind of the anecdotal stuff that a school might want. And these are schools that students are both getting into and not getting into. So it's a target. It could go either way. A viable reach to me is a school where the data is a little bit above where a student's falling, and there is a possibility for that option. Early decision would be one way to kind of reach for that possibility. Or maybe it's the case where a school's kind of general data is a lot stronger, but a student might be applying to a really nuanced program within the school, like visual art or dance or theater or something, where a portfolio or an audition will carry a pretty substantive part of that decision. And that could sometimes override what might be a more difficult school to get into. And then the far reaches are schools where it is the dream. It is pretty far out of reach. Even for students who have all the perfect metrics, right? They're valedictorian. They've got the perfect test score. They've taken the hardest classes the school has to offer. Maybe they're taking dual enrollment through a community college. They've got the leadership, all of it. I call these schools, they're just unpredictable. We don't know how they're going to go. So you don't want to apply to a bunch of unpredictable schools, even if you've got all the metrics. Statistically, there are 38,000 valedictorians in the U.S. So let that sink in for a second. It's a lot. That there's editors, you know, that many editors in chief, more captains, leads of play. So I think in a bubble, a lot of students are that premier school student at their high school, but there's those students exist everywhere. So it's really hard to know how these admissions offices are really going to sculpt their class.
Wow, that is a shocking number, isn't it? When you think of the top 10 selective schools, they could be filled in a second with just those valedictorians, not even counting the amazing athletes and the incredible artists and performers and all the things that make people really extraordinary students. Wow. When you talk about possibly getting into a viable reach or a reach school, do you think it's always a good idea to accept that if you can afford it? Like when students arrive at a school that's maybe above the metrics, are they going to be able to handle it?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I would say most students can handle it. It's just a matter of numbers, right? So the admission rate is a factor of how many students are applying. I honestly believe most students can go to their reach school and do the work and be highly successful. It's just a matter of getting in. So yeah, they can absolutely handle it. I have students for whom the reach school isn't their favorite. Their favorite is the target or likely. And that's a great problem to have, because they're probably going to get in and it's going to be a nice success story. I think for them, the struggle is they feel they should like the reach. They should want that school that's harder to get into and that can be challenging for them to really just embrace the target, the one that they like the most.
Right. So if a student and their family is going on a college tour, what kind of things would you recommend that they try to notice on that tour?
So I would always schedule a tour, an official tour. If you happen to be in an area on a family vacation, or if your trip is really college specific, always schedule a tour or information session through the admissions office, because many schools track what we call demonstrated interest. And this is a point of contact that each student has had with a college. I think that you're going to get to a point on college tours where the information starts to sound really similar. Everyone has a very specific first year program or a blue light system or a swipe card. You'll hear all these things from many different schools. I recommend always to just watch students. How are students interacting with each other? Are they engaged or are they buried in their phones? Pick up a school newspaper if that's in print. What are the hot topics on campus? Pull a student aside, ask if you can take 5 minutes of their time, buy them a coffee or something in the coffee shop, and just ask about their experience. I think that the admissions office is a really good place to get an overview, and there are other opportunities on campus to try and get more of that unfiltered perspective. If you have a friend there, see if you can visit with them while you're on campus. Take a couple minutes of their time. I think college tours tend to be really fast. Students are trying to get from one place to the next pretty quickly. There's often not time to visit a class or to do extensive things, but sometimes there are. So if you really care about school spirit, try and go to a game. If you really want to know about research opportunities, try and see if you can connect with somebody on campus to get a sense of that while you're there. Going into a college tour, I really recommend just thinking about what it is you value and trying to look for those things on your college tour. For most students, the college tour is where they're going to connect. They're not going to connect by reading a website or going through a big research book. They want to see people in the flesh, and they want to get a sense of whether what they're seeing is their experience and the people are their people.
Sure. That vibe is really important, isn't it? It's kind of intangible, but it does matter.
It does.
What kind of missteps have you seen families or students make as they're trying to manage this overwhelming process?
Starting too early. I think that starting too early can really, it's exhausting for the child. This is a long haul process. This is almost like running a marathon. You can go out and run a marathon untrained, unprepared. It's going to be really painful. Whereas if you train and you take that 6 months to really get your runs in and condition, it's going to be a fun experience. So I think that this is a marathon of an experience that requires test preparation and college visits and writing essays and really getting that list together. I think the missteps can be when a parent takes the wheel too much. Messages that their child isn't capable of doing it on their own. And that's definitely not the message we want young people going to college with. We want them going to college kind of, this is really an opportunity for them to assert their skills and abilities, and for them to know that when that final decision comes, they did the work. They really took the wheel. So I think that that's truly one of the biggest missteps. I think another big misstep is not having balance on the list. Balance is essential. You can't have 10 reaches and one target. That just, people need to go to bed at night, and I would not go to bed at night knowing that that was my student's list.
That makes a lot of sense. I know there are some kind of almost college calculators or engines out there that you can punch in the parameters, that the things that you're looking for, and they give you some options. Do you have any tools that you recommend that parents could check out?
Yeah, I would start with your school. Your school probably has a platform called Naviance or SCORE or Cialfo or something of some sort. And there are often scattergrams on these databases that are school specific.
Jill, I'm sorry. I don't know what a scattergram is. Could you tell us what that is?
Sure. A scattergram is a graph. So on one axis is the GPA, and on the other axis are scores. And then you get different plots on the scattergram that is, they're school specific plots, right? So if you plug in University of Utah, you can get a sense of, okay, how many students from Park City High got into University of Utah and what were their metrics? So that's kind of a great way to really utilize that particular database. There's one that I really love called College Kickstart. It's something you would need to pay for. It's a subscription-based program. I use it with all of my students. And this is a program that compiles national data, and it will actually give families a grade on their college list. So they put in their GPA and their test scores, and they get a grade. It's a college list building tool. And that profile I just mentioned, the 10 reaches and the one target, would probably get a D minus maybe on the list. It's not balanced. So that could be a really good place to start. And I would be remiss to not mention, we're just talking about metrics, right? Like, there's so many other factors that come into this process, a student's activities, their leadership, their life experience, the content of their essays, their letters of recommendation, who they are as a student in the classroom and within the community. There's so many kind of non-quantitative pieces that really flesh out how these decisions are made. But those are kind of, going back to the databases, those tend to be two that I use pretty frequently. My favorite college resource guide is called FISK, Guide to Colleges, FISKE. It's an easy 3-page read. You can pick up any version, whether it's the 2025 version or if your next door neighbor finished the process 2 years ago and they want to give you their old resource book. It's, the information's pretty much the same, but it gives you a sense of the personality of a school. And if you really like the personality at the end of the 3-page read, there's maybe 7 schools that the FISK guide will recommend that are similar that you might want to research. So that's a way to really ease your way into trying to find schools that you may not know about.
Oh, that's terrific. I think that's part of the challenge, is that we've all heard of the Harvards and Yales and Stanfords, but there are many places to get an incredible education, but don't happen to be household names. It'd be a wonderful way to find some of those, I bet.
It's a great way to research universities or some international schools profiled, liberal arts colleges. So it's a kind of a grouping of about 350, 400 schools in that particular guide. Wow.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jill Gulley, a college consultant or independent educational consultant who helps families as their students are looking for a good fit of a college that they both want to go to and can hopefully get into. I know during COVID, a lot of schools kind of lifted their need to see ACT and SAT scores, but it looks like that's coming back as a requirement for many schools. If your kid is a wonderful student but doesn't happen to be a spectacular test taker, are there still schools that don't require it?
There are plenty of schools that don't require it and will continue to remain test optional. Yes. The juniors with whom I'm working, all but one are spending the fall working on test preparation for SAT or ACT. And it's because so many schools have gone back. And it's just hard to know whether a school that a student might eventually really fall in love with re-implements testing. So some students don't want to test. And I would say this is really a family decision, right? If that's not going to be a strength of your child's, if you know that your child will be applying to schools that are test optional, or if a school does re-implement, that school falls off their list, that is perfectly fine. So to your point, the most competitive schools have gone back. There is also a pretty big trend for schools in the South, Southeast to go back. Some of them never went optional, but we are seeing more of the big publics in the Southeast go back. And I imagine that schools who plan to re-implement these mandates for next year, that we'll learn about those, I would hope, before winter break, to give students the opportunity to prepare if that school is on their list, versus last year, all of them went back in May and it gave students very little time to prepare if they hadn't done so already.
Okay. Any last word for parents as we're embarking on the process?
Sure. I would say that if you are looking at hiring an IEC, do a lot of research. Have conversations with a couple of folks. Really ask about their philosophy. Ask about how long they've worked in the profession. Have they actually worked in admissions? Have they actually worked in school-based college counseling? It's not a one-size-fits-all. How many files have they reviewed? You'll often find that if your student is looking at something really nuanced, like, let's say, dance, I work with a lot of high-end dancers, but I onboard somebody to give me an assessment of their talent because I don't want to put Juilliard on a student's list if there's no way they're going to make it to the audition phase, right? And so ask if they onboard professionals who can really help evaluate certain things to help you scaffold the list. And then I would say your child's going to college. There's nothing to really stress out about. Give yourself a little bit of a runway, but this process is entirely manageable.
Wonderful. And if people want to reach you specifically, how do they find you?
You can find me on my website, which is www.gullycc.com.
Perfect. Jill Gully, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Recent years have seen book bans surging nationwide, creating division and multifaceted concerns among parents, communities, and librarians. The heated exchanges and accusations in one Louisiana parish resulted in librarian Amanda Jones being targeted by vicious threats, social media attacks, and public harassment. Her new book, That Librarian, tells the story of how this former Librarian of the Year found herself targeted, maligned, and threatened, and how it has led to her becoming a right to read activist. Amanda Jones, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start by having you give our listeners a little background on what led you to write this book.
Well, in July of 2022, I went as a resident of my community, the community I've lived in my entire life, and I went and spoke at a public library board meeting about censorship because there were censorship attempts happening in our parish. We're parishes, not counties, in Louisiana. And I just gave a basic censorship speech. And so did everybody else that from my community that went and spoke. And an out-of-town activist was there to rile up our community. Who had been very integral in costing a neighboring parish library system millions in funding and an overtaking of their library board by extremists. And so I went and spoke. 4 days later, I woke up to an onslaught of hate online. It was a targeted harassment campaign by two men in particular, saying that I advocate the teaching of anal sex to children, 11-year-olds, and then I give pornography and erotica to 6-year-olds. I am a school librarian, but I went and spoke at my public library, not a bit, and I didn't identify where I worked, but they identified where I worked. And so for weeks, they were posting about me, and the comments were just filled with hate. I needed to be shot, killed. I'm a pedo, a groomer. I received a death threat. And, it's been 2 years, and they're still harassing me. People are still doing these things, but I wanted to get the truth out because I refuse to go back on social media, back and forth with people. There's no sense in it. So I wanted to tell my truth and what really happened. And so I was offered a book deal to write this book. And so I did. And that's how the book came to be.
Well, we're glad you did. This is a really important topic, and people have very strong feelings about it. So back in 2022, when you spoke at that meeting, one of several speakers, what were the specific remarks that people seemed to take issue with?
Well, they never really said. Basically, they're insinuating that I think that children should have access to all books. And that's not what I said. I went and said that we have trained professional librarians who read professional reviews and place library materials appropriately in the right sections of the library, but that if someone in the community does not like a book or where it's located, they can fill out a challenge form. And I reiterated that 3 times, that we had policies and procedures in place. There was no need for panic. they didn't like that. That's, you know, that's just basic common sense of the truth, and they didn't like that. But I also said, you know, I quoted the Trevor Project. I talked about how historically marginalized communities are usually targeted in book banning and censorship attempts. And I said, I think something I did say that I was raised in my community, that God is love. But as an adult, I came to realize that God is only love if you have the same political and religious beliefs as everyone else. And that didn't go over very well. And that's what started it. And then I think that had I backed down, it probably would be over with by now. But I chose to file a defamation lawsuit that is still ongoing today. I think that's why they haven't stopped their harassment. And it's a multitude of people, their friends and family. And when I say harassment, I mean on every single social media platform. I can't go out in public in my very small town without being called names. I'm worried about my safety at all times when I'm out in public. I lost chunks of hair. I had panic attacks. This has truly affected my life. So it's not been a cakewalk.
No. Situations like this can really affect one's worldview. Do you feel that your faith in people has changed?
It did at first, but when I realized it's the same 15 or 20 people, and that I like to say that for every one death threat I received, I've received thousands of messages of support.
Oh, that's great.
Not necessarily from inside my community, but from outside of my community when they hear my story. So I go back and forth. I want to believe the best in people.
That's not too far off from something that Anne Frank said in a book that has been banned in the past. Do you feel that book banning in our current times is different from the way it was 50, 60 years ago when it was also in the headlines?
It's very similar. Just now the focus is on, people will say that there are sexually explicit materials in children's sections, and there are not. And what they say is sexually explicit, you'll realize, has usually a book that has nothing to do with sex, and it's just has a character or by an author of the LGBTQIA+ community. Whereas, you know, I would say 50, 60 years ago, it wasn't necessarily this moral panic of protecting children, but information access as a whole, especially civil rights issues, Black history, things like that, which we are still seeing today in the challenged books. But it's a whole new, it's a whole different type of moral panic. It is similar to the, when I started education, I'm a 24-year educator. When I first started, there was the Harry Potter panic. You know, if you read this, you're going to want to do spells or witchcraft or whatever. But everybody recognized that that was silly. And people are not recognizing that what we're seeing now is actually a suppression of ideas and further marginalization of entire communities. It's not silly. It's telling certain people in our society that they do not matter.
Right. Your book made me think a lot about the availability of information that has grown exponentially with the internet. Do you ever feel that the vitriol coming from these people who are attacking you is a displaced anger because they can't control the internet and the access to information that it provides?
Yes, I've noticed that, you know, back in 2020 when COVID first came out, I noticed a huge rise in social media use because people weren't leaving their homes. And certain political candidates, that are in the public eye started using hate rhetoric and things like that. And this is just, it's just snowballed. And people were mad then about masks and vaccines. And it just kind of, they switched to this topic. I think that anytime someone you choose to target and harass someone, like these people have chosen to target and harass me, obviously there's something in their lives that they have a hole in their heart and they're trying to fill it in some way. And I'm the way they're trying to get their anger out. And I wish that wasn't the case. And I wish they would maybe look internally at themselves, but they don't. And it's just, it gets worse every year and it's fueled by social media. False information is being spread, moral panic, but yeah, it's definitely social media and the internet. And you know, these people are not, they don't seem to be concerned with the phones in the in their 10, 11, and 12-year-old's hands, but it's the thought that they might come across a sexual health book or a book with a gay character in the library. And that's just, I mean, that's absurd to me.
Yeah. Here in Utah, we have a population well known for being religious. We've had a lot of stories in the news in recent days about the current Utah laws regarding removal of books from school libraries. What would you say to those who assert that banning books is part of their right in protecting their children?
I will say I did read a few weeks ago about Utah banning 13 books in all of the school systems because of the new law that said that if it's objected to in three school systems, it's then banned statewide. And I was fortunate to hear author Ellen Hopkins talk about one of her books that is being banned. And, you know, these books save lives. So say it's a book that talks about tough topics. First of all, they're not found next to green eggs and ham in the little kids section or in an elementary school. These are books that are found in usually high school libraries or teen and adult sections of public libraries. So this moral panic that little children have access, this is just not the case. But, you know, I have unfortunately in my 24 years taught children that have been the victims of abuse and things like that, or that are, you know, Ellen Hopkins writes, and I'm using Ellen because I know several of her books are banned, drug addiction. We in Louisiana, we have a very high rate of drug overdoses, drug addiction. And these teenagers, you know, in a high school, you have kids 16, 17, 18, sometimes 19 and 20, and they're just struggling to understand their families and their lives. And to completely cut off access and ban them from these books is not doing them, it's doing them a disservice.
Right. It's hard to argue sometimes with people who have their mind so set about something and they've decided that this is the evil that they're going to need to stamp out. Having said that, it's really easy to vilify the book banning community, but have there been any things that did come up that you thought, you know what, maybe that should be in a protected environment?
Yes, actually, yeah, I do public records requests for our public library to see what books are challenged. And there is an amazing series of books written by Sarah J. Maas, The Court of Thorn and Roses, I believe is the name of the series. It's an amazing series. The first book is young adult, so I could see teens reading it. But as you get into the series, it becomes very adult. And it's rated professionally reviewed as adult books. So yeah, when someone challenged that series at my public library, and I thought, well, you know, the first one could stay in young, in my opinion, I don't work there, but the first one could stay in the young adult section, but the others need to be an adult. Well, the library made the decision to move all of them to the adult section to keep the series together. And that just made sense. That's common sense. It made sense to me. And you know, older teens that still want to read it can go to the adult section to get it. But I would have read that book as a teen. I would have read the whole series. But I also believe in parental rights. I do believe in parental rights. And if someone doesn't want their own child to read it, you know, that's understandable. You just don't have to destroy an entire library or ban dozens of books because you don't want your own child to read that.
Sure. I so appreciate that. And thank you for answering that, because I just didn't want listeners to think that this is all about absolute, you know, no holds barred, everything for everybody, because that's not the way the librarians that I've known have come at it. Most librarians have been these incredible people who just love books, and they want to turn on young minds to the stuff that will really ignite their curiosity and fascination with things. What led you to become a librarian in the first place?
Well, I was in college to be an elementary education teacher. And it was, speaking of Harry Potter, it was when the first three Harry Potter books came out, and it reignited my passion for reading. My whole life I was a reader, but I, you know, in high school and college, I kind of got out of it because you're busy and I was working and going to school. And but it reignited that passion. And I just remembered I had some college professors in my literature classes that I got back into reading. And I felt, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to read aloud to kids, and I want to show kids these amazing stories. And so I went and got special permission as an undergrad to take library science classes. I was the only undergrad in the graduate courses so that I could graduate with both. And so that's what I did.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you had me at the introduction or the dedication of your book to Judy Blume, who was an author that I grew up with. And she's a great example. Like, I remember there were books of hers when I was in junior high and late elementary school. Some of her books definitely had adult themes, and some of them were children's books. And so as a parent, I'm sure they had to get in there and do a little investigating to make sure that that book is appropriate for their child. And that's a part of everyone's process, or it should be, right? Because we have so little control over some of the things our kids are seeing on their phones, as you pointed out. So we have to take that step. What steps do you recommend that parents or caregivers take in order just to kind of keep tabs on and be able to recommend great books for their kids?
Well, I always say, because this gets lost in the shuffle too, that libraries usually have policies for unaccompanied minors. yet we see parents dropping their children off at the library, like as if it's a daycare. And I think that parents should take an active role. When my child, I always let her just walk around the library, and I would follow at a distance. And if she had any questions, and sometimes as a junior high student, she did pick out some adult manga books. And I said, you know, I don't think we're ready for those just yet, but here are some manga books that are more, you know, your age range. You have to take an interest in your children, what they're reading, and talk to them. And they are going to want to read things that are tough, you know, topics. Judy Blume, I love Judy Blume, and she wrote about puberty and racism. But she wrote it in such a way for children to understand these topics. Parents do their children a disservice by completely taking these books away when there are books like Judy, you know, authors like Judy Blume who write books about tough topics that are age appropriate for children. One of the best examples I have is Barbara Dee is a current author, and I love to tell people they should, you know, junior high, middle schoolers should be reading Barbara Dee, because she's like the Judy Blume of these kids, for these kids. Oh. And she writes about such tough topics, but they're so age appropriate and with such tact and language that is for children to understand. Because we do have kids that have parents that are addicted to opioids, which is the topic of one of her books. We have, you know, children who have been abused by relatives, and she tackles, you know, tough topics like consent and like if someone's making you uncomfortable to speak out, but in a way for children. And but you just, you, there are books out there that, like, you know, other books like Barbara Dee's that are the Judy Blume books for these kids. But take an active interest. Don't just block it out, because if you block it out completely, you don't talk about these issues with your children, that's when they are going to turn to their internet and the phones, right? And they're going to get information that's not safe,
right?
And that's when you know, the unsafe information.
Yeah. And denial of socio-cultural issues is not an effective approach. These things do exist. And what a gift it is that we have such thoughtful and skilled authors out there that are making age-appropriate stories where children can learn about it in a way that hopefully they can understand at any age. Let's talk a little bit about how this has all affected you. How are you doing?
Every day is different. With the release of my book, it has been an onslaught of hate once again. You know, and then people just make up lies. And again, this goes back to the same 15, 20 people from 2 years ago that started it. And I'm starting to see more pushback in my community. People are saying, you know, that's not the truth. That's not what she said. That's not what she did. That's not... So it's getting better. But I've also been through a lot of therapy to understand that that's just the way it's going to be if I continue to speak out, and I'm not going to stop speaking out. So it just, I have to take the good with the bad, but there's so much more good for me. I'm trying to make lemonade out of lemons, and I just take each day as they come.
Thank you for that. Do you think that the divisive political climate that we're seeing throughout the U.S., is that a big part of this rise in book banning and vehement challenging of books, as well as these intensely personal attacks? Or is that something that might have just happened anyway?
It's 100% what is driving all of this. is the political climate. We're seeing, you know, no matter what state you live in, what you'll see is maybe someone in a community will, you know, object to a book or post it in social media. The politicians run with it. And they run with it and stir up and help stir up the panic so that they, you will elect them. So they will come in with solutions to problems that don't exist issue. And you look at the current, and I'm not going to name names, but the current vice presidential candidates, you've got one who just the other day got on stage in front of a crowd and said, people are trying to give toddlers sexually explicit books, which is not happening. And you have another vice presidential candidate who has signed an anti-book banning bill and says that it's very important that we have libraries with trained librarians who can help make these determinations to keep our children safe. So yeah, it's definitely divisive. They're not helping things, some of them.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And then, so you did file a lawsuit. How is the lawsuit progressing?
Well, initially the judge dismissed my case and said it's just their opinions that I advocate the teaching of anal sex to 11-year-olds, and it's just their opinion that I give children pornography and erotica. And she labeled me a public figure, which at the time I wasn't, but I will concede that now I am a public figure.
You're becoming one now.
Yeah. She just dismissed it and she wouldn't even listen. She wouldn't even look at the evidence. I could prove malice. I could prove all four prongs of defamation. She wouldn't listen to it. So we filed, you know, an appeal, and at the appellate court, they tried to get out of it with the technicality. So now we have filed to the Louisiana Supreme Court. And so we filed this week, actually, our final rebuttal. So in a month or two, I should know if the Louisiana Supreme Court is going to hear my case or not. But I'll say that I'm not asking for a lot. All I'm asking for these two men is a dollar and an apology.
I think that goes a long way for people seeing that this is not about anything other than trying to protect the right to read. Is that how you would describe the foundation of your argument?
Yes, I would say the right to read, intellectual freedom, and the right, and also protect educators and librarians, because I'm tired of seeing, I'm just one of hundreds that are just bashed constantly in social media. And I think there need to be more laws and more help for educators and librarians who are being harassed online for just simply doing our jobs. And I don't know a single librarian or educator who, we don't make a lot of money. At least here in Louisiana, we don't. We go into our jobs because we love our communities and we love kids. And, you know, I used to say that I was going to be in my job forever. And they're wearing me down. I can't wait till I can retire. And I'm sad about that. And I'm hoping that, you know, I can find that love again. But it's tough. It's really tough.
I'm so disappointed in the situation that it's led to that. That's really, really frustrating. And especially for it to happen in the town you call home. I'm sure that's very disheartening. Although I would venture to guess that there'd be a number of communities around the country that would be thrilled to have you.
Well, the thing is, in 2021, I was named the National School Librarian of the Year. And I was paraded in front of the school board. And my school board rep told me, she cried with tears. You're one of the best things that's ever happened to our community. And fast forward, and she's joining in. But this is my community, too. I've lived here my entire life. My child lives here. My family lives here. And if I left, what does that say to the kids? Like, when the going gets tough, you leave?
Indeed. Well, if people listening would like to become more involved with this issue, what would you recommend they do?
They should pay attention. That's the biggest thing. Pay attention. If they want to find out more about it, I always suggest Kelly Jensen is a former librarian author. She writes every Friday. It's called the Weekly Censorship Roundup. And she writes about stories of censorship all across the United States. Go read her articles. You'll be amazed, but pay attention within your own community. Look at agendas, or public agendas are always posted for library board and school board meetings, and look at the agendas. And the biggest thing, you know, find out facts before you spread lies about other people. It sets a really bad example to children when the adults are easily spreading false information, as particularly about their own teachers and librarians. It just sets a really bad example.
Yes. And as we hear from the very first days of parenting, always remember that your kids are watching closely. They will do what you do, not what you say. They're watching.
Yes, they are.
The book is That Librarian, The Fight Against Book Banning in America. And if you have concerns about the way books and librarians are being treated across the country, this will give you a much deeper look into how it's affecting library professionals and how you can stay informed about books that may be currently under review in your own community. Amanda Jones, any final words for our listeners?
Just get out and vote. Get out and vote because, you know, voting matters. And if you care about something like this issue, look and see where people stand on these issues. And if your politicians are constantly bashing educators and librarians, I don't think that those are the type of politicians that should be in charge.
All right. Amanda Jones, thank you so much for being with us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. If you missed part of today's show or would like to share it, you can access it, along with all past shows, on our website, kpcw.org. Also, did you know we have a podcast? We do. Please listen or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you have an idea for the show, we're interested. Please contact us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.